Greetings, this is Eric Andelin, Senior Photogrammetry Workflow Specialist with SimActive, and you're listening to Episode 18, Three Ways to Speed Up Photogrammetry of the Pixels and Points Podcast. And with me today, I have Don Cummins, owner of Aerial Data Solutions. Don, say hi to everyone.
Hello.
There you go. Now we're off and running. So, Don, I've worked at ADS, but not your ADS. I worked at the one in Oklahoma. Different companies, different times, but I love seeing the hat. That's really cool. So give us a little bit of information, background on yourself and your company.
All right. It's funny you bring up the Oklahoma ADS because we were probably in business 2 or 3 years when we first came across them. Yep. And I said, look at this company. They've got our name. And so I started doing some research on them and realized they've been around for much longer than I've even been alive. And so got connected with them a little bit over the years. And sometimes there's some confusion, but
yeah,
same initials, almost the same name.
Yeah.
And we're just happy to be playing kind of in the same ballpark.
Yeah, outstanding.
It's been a great journey. A little bit about ADS. I founded the company in 2014. It stemmed from what I call my prior life, where I was a ranch manager and raised cattle, worked in agriculture. And I really just wanted to fly airplanes kind of for fun and started taking some photos out the window of the planes of cornfields and bean fields and cattle pastures. And people started asking for these photos. And next I needed to figure out where I was, and I took the photos and brought in GPS positioning. So what started as a hobby turned into a business, which is still a blast. I still learn every day. I'm by no means an expert, but we've done pretty well over the last several years, and we're excited to see where it's going to go in the next years.
So, I mean, how many people do you have working with you?
Currently, there's about 15 employees.
Okay.
With ADS.
Mm-hmm.
We have about 6 pilots full time. We also employ some contract pilots to help us as needed. And I flash as myself, not as many as I used to. So I get to sit behind the desk a lot more and try to work up jobs and build relationships and do all that while the pilots are out having all the fun. Processing LiDAR and photogrammetry, and all that's done right here in the office beside me. And we have an excellent team that's a whole lot smarter than I am that figures out how to do all of that magic after the planes land.
I mean, I kind of ended up in the business the same way. My dad was like you. He was, you know, retired Marine, loved flying, built his own airplanes. And at some point he worked for an engineering company. He actually worked for Fugro in California and led their mapping department at the time in California. And the guy that he subcontracted all the flying to was getting ready to retire. And he said to my dad, hey, you want to buy the company? And he did. And 40 years later, I'm still here. So, yeah, I can understand the desire to fly and to do photography and you know, geek out on imagery from everywhere in the world. So, very cool. So, what kind of planes do you guys fly?
We fly twin engine, single engine piston aircraft.
Okay.
Also, helicopters for leak detection and smaller lower level photogrammetry or video jobs that are carrying cameras, 4-band cameras, and terrain mappers and city mappers. So they do the majority of the work. And then we also have some single engine 206s, 182s
mm-hmm.
that get tasked on the jobs or the linear work.
Okay.
And they're strut mounts or small holes in them for the smaller cameras.
Okay, cool. So a reminder to our listener, this podcast came from a webinar, so there is a visual component in our conversation. If you would like to view that webinar, you can download it at our website, simactive.com. And the topics are going to be, and these all relate to how you can speed up your photogrammetry, but know your projects, planning an acquisition for those projects, and then processing to meet the requirements that your customers are asking for. So we can start with knowing your projects. And I mean, project types tend to determine what platform and what sensor you may own or may be using. Each one has its own sweet spot. Some are workhorses that can do everything. Some are, you know, dedicated to specific missions. But, you know, efficient acquisition speed, you know, ownership cost, all those things play into what you're doing with your aircraft or your acquisition platform. So in general, I mean, what kind of projects do you guys get involved in?
That's a great question. I wish I could give a general answer, but part of my problem is I have a hard time saying no.
That's
so
okay.
We projects that run from very small to very large.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked on statewide projects with four-band mapping, statewide, countywide projects with LIDAR.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a bid out right now for a 20-acre timber tract. And okay. So it is as large or small as they come. But like you said, matching the sensors with the aircraft with the job is critical. And you know, it's worked for us to have several different to choose from, because it allows us to be able to not only say yes, but perform efficiently as well. If we can stack jobs together, then we can make the bigger sensors, the bigger planes work. But if we can't, then we try to get there as cheaply as possible on the smaller jobs and get it knocked out with a less expensive platform and aircraft. A lot of thought goes into the planning and the logistics of who goes where, to not waste time or cost on sensors that could be better used elsewhere.
Right, absolutely. So you kind of do everything. So you talked about leak detection, projects as small as 20 acres, statewide projects. So you kind of, like you say, you get your hands involved in everything. So, you know, what are some of the typical challenges you might face with these projects?
Well, the standard challenge is always weather. I don't think I have to spend a whole lot of time on that. Either you have the weather for the collects or you don't.
Yep.
The other challenges that may or may not be unique to us, I'm sure everybody faces those, like you said, is access and remoteness to some areas. We do fly as far as Hawaii to Maine to Florida, so everywhere in between. And sometimes being remote creates its own issues, because you don't know if you have the ground logistics to support your aerial operations. You have to make relationships with people in those locations just in order to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's a challenge, it's also a lot of fun, because you get to learn different ways of doing things and meet new people and they support you, and you in turn get to support them at some point as well. So that is a challenge as well. In addition to that is really the logistics of keeping the airplanes busy but not overtasking them, I think is one that I juggle on a constant basis, because we want to be responsive and quick and get the jobs done in a timely manner, which requires having a lot of equipment available, but we also don't want to have a lot of equipment available that's not doing anything.
Yeah.
So managing that aspect of it, and sometimes it involves reaching out by faith and saying, okay, we're going to invest in this and have it ready to go and hope that the work follows. Or sometimes it's, we just have to push twice as hard right now and get through this.
Yep.
Because there's nothing able to come back and support it on the back end. So just kind of managing the demand with what's coming down the pipe, and also keeping the schedules. And we've really made a name for ourselves, which I think everybody tries to and does a really good job at it despite all the challenges, but just not over promising.
Yeah.
And hopefully over delivering and staying on schedule, because we understand that our schedule problems are not our clients' schedule problems. They, you know, if we get behind because of weather or maintenance or just poor planning or whatever it is, it doesn't really matter, because to the client, what our problems are, they still need the data. So whatever it takes to get, and sometimes that means reaching out to some other people in the industry and asking them if they can step in and help. We're not an island. We can't do it all ourselves. So bringing in some help from other companies, I don't see it as competition. I see it as we're helping each other out so that everybody can continue to grow and to get the job done and serve their clients. Those are probably some of the biggest challenges that we face on a day-to-day basis. We've got an awesome maintenance department here, and sometimes keeping these things running is a big part of the challenge, but we're blessed to have, I call them miracle workers, that they somehow keep these things running. And then the magic of the sensors and everything as well. I tell my crews to speak sweetly to the sensors because they respond to that. Just try to treat everything nicely, and that seems to help keep things running a little bit more smoothly.
Well, you brought up a good point a bit ago about our competitors, we would call them. They are all our peers. So, for example, when I was working in Southern California doing this, we all knew each other. We all knew each other so well that, you know, we might be up in the air and we've been mobilized for 10 jobs that day and the day is getting short and we're not on site. And, you know, we'll call out the tail number of the guys that, you know, work down the street and say, hey, you know, we can't get there in time. Can you pick up these lines for us? And, you know, this was before cell phones and, you know, anything. We just all knew how to take care of each other, because you're right. The reality is, we're all ultimately working for the same engineers, the same people. And if as a group, we can provide the data on time and efficiently to help them get to their answers faster, it's better for all of us. So that's a good point you brought up about, you know, teaming up and working together when you know, you're stretched to your limits. So very good point. So you mentioned a little bit about sensors. And you've said that you've got aircraft and helicopter access. I assume you have some drones.
We do.
Okay. So you've got the gamut of equipment. Obviously, you mentioned also that you have 4-band sensors. You have access to LiDAR. I imagine sometimes you're doing dual collects with those.
Yes, sometimes.
Yep.
Our LiDAR systems has a 4-band Nader camera. The other has oblique cameras, so sometimes we'll collect, and sometimes it's just straight LiDAR. I'll say the dual collects have a lot more challenges than the straight LiDAR. They really save a lot of time and money as well if you can collect it both on the same swaths.
Yeah, and you know, for some of our listeners, not all LiDAR units and cameras have the same acquisition swath, so you have a couple of options there. You can fly to fit the one that will accommodate both, or you can do worst off maybe a dual collect, or maybe it's easier to collect the LiDAR at night versus the imagery in the daytime. So there's all kinds of issues that come up with that you mentioned, but there's also a sweet spot for that too. So it's well worth having, and as the manufacturers start working more together, we're starting to see more cohesiveness in how they collect and how those swaths get closer to each other, so that you don't have to do a dual collect. But I would imagine your decisions on buying sensors, just like it would be aircraft, are really dictated by the type of projects you guys get involved in.
It is. Yeah, the projects usually drive the acquisitions of sensors. Sometimes the sensors actually start off as a platforming project where the client provides the sensor and we fly it, and then we see what it can do and what it's capable of. And if those type of projects increase, then we kind of have firsthand knowledge. Other times it's just you build off of what you know. We've been using phase one cameras for many years, and we know what they can do and what they're good at, and that kind of pushes the types of projects that we go after because of that type of sensor. And so it's a little bit of both. You know, you work with what you have and you grow that, but sometimes something comes in from left field and you have to go research and figure out what kind of sensor will work for that. And that's more the case with the leak detection. There's lots of technology out there, and some of them work better in some environments and some instances and others. So
you mentioned that you have a helicopter as well, which I assume means you're working with pod-based sensor containers, I guess I would call them, which probably brings challenges as well.
Right. So the helicopter that we use actually has a gimbal that's based in the back seat of the helicopter, and it looks out outside. Okay. But we do use pods on some of the aircraft, so I'm familiar with, I think, what you're getting at.
So you mentioned drones. So, you know, what, we're 12 years into drones now, I think. I think that's how long they've been around. Have you figured out what they're good for yet?
I would like to say yes. And for what they're best at is jobs that we can't get to with the other platforms, is in my experience. Mm-hmm. So our experience with drones goes back to 2014 or so. And it was really, started flying airplanes first, and I just wanted to get closer photos of certain things that I couldn't get to with the airplane. Mm-hmm. So that's, and then we started pushing drone services. We invested in some long range, beyond line of sight technology before that was really a thing. Put a lot of money into bigger multi-rotor drones, bigger sensors. And honestly, the pucker factor of flying a drone with an expensive sensor never left. And we did a lot of missions with these, and the goal always became, let's figure out a way to scale this to the airplane and get the sensor. Now, that's probably not a popular thing to say going into UAV Expo next week, but drones definitely have their place, and the jobs that they can do, only they can do. So finding that sweet spot between what makes sense for the aircraft, what makes sense for the drone, and not trying to force the other one into that location, I think is the key. And from a drone perspective, you can do anything with a drone. From an airplane perspective, well, we can do anything with an airplane. And I think marrying those two ideas and saying, all right, we each got a space, this one's efficient here, and it makes sense to send a crew, spend a day on this location and knock it out versus tasking an airplane to fly, and vice versa. Sometimes you'll see people trying to tackle a you know, 10 square mile job with a drone that takes days, many days to fly, and then many, many days to process the data. And the imagery can be good, the data can be good, but if you're, what we found with the imagery side of it is, even if you have great conditions, it takes so long to collect that your sun angle changing throughout the day, and the difference in maybe a high overcast the next day creates a lot of additional processing problems that you had to deal with later, that if you could collect it all within an hour or two, you don't have to deal with. So those are kind of the extreme examples where we finally decided to kind of put each one in its box and try not to force one into doing the job that's better suited for the other.
Yeah, and I asked that question tongue in cheek because drones do have their place for sure. They do create higher resolution images. They, like you said, they can go where aircraft might not necessarily go, or it's just more feasible to send a drone to do something. And I just think off the top of my head, if you've got a project out in the Caribbean, you really probably don't want to send your aircraft out there to wait and wait and wait and wait for clear skies to really get something done. Whereas if it's small enough, you know, the drone could probably do that for you. And they really do excel at small projects. I do agree with you. There's a huge pucker factor when you've got, you know, $300,000 worth of cameras and LiDAR equipment underneath, you know, an $80,000 gas powered drone. The mission becomes, let's finish this mission and get it back down on the ground.
As long as we're carrying these expensive sensors, there's always going to be a pucker factor no matter what.
Yeah.
Making the drones pay for themselves is a challenge that I think we're getting there.
So do you use them in any of the methane detection or anything like that? Are you working on it in that way as well?
We actually started with methane detection with drones, handheld and drones. And then we moved to helicopter because our projects got bigger, the corridors got long, and we were spending days and days out in the field flying these drones. And then access became a problem because on corridors, sometimes you have landowner issues where they don't want you on their land. You can only fly this thing so far. So our crews are spending time just trying to get to the spot so they could fly. And then dealing with unhappy landowners or people who what you were doing, so they call the police on you and having to try to sort that out. So we'd usually have an additional person on site just to deal with all the excess so that the drone crews stay focused on what they were doing. And there's a lot of concern, and people don't know what you're actually looking at while you're flying over their house. And it seems like you're spying on them. And we don't really care what's in the backyard of your house until you start wondering why we're there. And then we wonder why you care. So it's
Good point. Good point. So let's talk a little bit about planning and acquisition. Once you've created your, stall full of aircraft and sensors based on the type of projects that you have, now as you said, you got to start looking at them for how am I going to capture this information in a way that it will be efficient to process? Because processing is still a big chunk of, or the biggest chunk of your project that's time consuming, and you want to minimize that amount of processing time. I remember not long ago where you would flip your images from RGB to black and white just because they're smaller file sizes and you could run them through faster. That's not the case anymore, but it was an option. Talk about a little bit about, how you determine how you look at it when you're setting up a project to make this thing the most efficient to bring into whatever software you're using.
yeah, that's a great question because so much planning goes into the processing end of it. We of course want to keep our collection times down as low as possible, but sometimes we pose two scenarios. Do we want to spend longer collecting and less time processing, or do we want to spend the vice versa? And if in some instances, and we've had sometimes where we tried to cut too hard on the collection side and we suffered on the processing, and that either had to spend a whole lot of extra time or else go back and refly it. So we do push that to the limits, or we try to, so that we know just how far we can go. And like you said, if you can make the file sizes and the photos smaller, sometimes that helps as well. Some clients will accept that, some will not. And so looking at all factors in the beginning helps us determine not only how long is this going to take to collect, but approximate as schedule on the processing end as well. And what we've kind of found over the years is when we first started this before SimActive, we used Structure for Motion software, which required a lot more overlap and longer processing times, as well as longer collection times. So when we moved to SimActive Correlator for our main processing software, we were able to cut our collections in half or more. And at first it was concerning because that was all that we knew. And we thought, how in the world can this do as good of a job? Until we started getting experience with it and seeing that, yes, not only can it do as good of a job, it can do a better job. And it's really industry standard. It's accepted practice to fly 60/30 and 60/40 if you're in terrain or something that you got some building lean or whatever it is that you want to collect a little more overlap. So now the only time we have to increase overlap is if it's either terrain or very urban areas with lots of tall buildings and bridges and things that you just need those extra looks. So the ability of the software to kind of help us be flexible in how we collect really helps us, and being able to quote these jobs specifically based around what the deliverables are. On the planning end, typically we're shooting 60/30 on most projects, and we can use the four band, three band. Sometimes it makes sense to chop it up and process two separate three band data sets instead of going straight with the four band, because the client wants color infrared instead of four band. Mm-hmm. And it's very nice to be able to use that same AT and that same DSM that's created from the initial processing and just dump in the color infrared images and run a new mosaic. So
yes,
that SimActive brings saves us a lot of time if we go that route. And it's definitely something that we consider on the front end when we're quoting those projects.
A couple of things you mentioned there. So obviously, right off the bat, when you're talking to your customer, you know, and they say, well, I need this level of detail on my mapping, you're the one who knows, you know, at what resolution or what ground sample distance will meet the accuracy requirements that he wants. And sometimes they've just heard they can get super high resolution stuff. And then they don't realize that, well, you know, there's a cost to that. And if you really want that, I can give that to you. It's going to exceed your accuracy requirements. So do you really want that? So I think that is a big part of speeding up your photogrammetric processing, knowing exactly what your client wants and helping educate them on how we get to that solution. The other thing you talked about was the type of project. If you're doing urban areas or areas where you've got a lot of building lean or a lot of elevation, then you're probably going to want to have more overlap just to cover yourself when you're trying to make, for instance, those models, that clean orthomosaic, what have you. But if you're out in the middle of nowhere, you know, go back to the 60-30 rule. And I had this question from somebody doing emergency response just recently that said, hey, you know, we want to process our data faster. How can we do that? And my question was, well, how much, you know, overlap and sidelap of your question is 80-60? I'm like, why are you doing that? You don't need to do that. So, you know, go back to the golden rule of photogrammetry, 60-30, you know, 60-40, whatever, but it's fewer images, and every image takes an amount of time to process. So the more you can reduce that number, the better off you are. And you're right, SimActive's been around a long time. It's based on photogrammetry as opposed to structure from motion. So, you know, we can work with less overlap. Our AT solutions tend to work better. And again, that just means faster processing. So other than that, I like what you said about being able to capture, you know, multiple bands and, you know, process out the RGB and then just drop in the other band later on, because it's already been processed. All you have to do is make mosaics out of that. The camera solution's the same. The AT solution's the same. You can cut some time out. People learn this as they start working with our software or anybody's software. You know, how can I make this more efficient? How can I not shortcut the system, but come up with ways to do this faster? And there certainly are ways to do that. I talked about, you know, back when drones first came out, you know, the camera wasn't associated with anything controlling it except for a firing sequence, and it would go off, you know, every X amount of seconds, whether you were in a turn or not, you know, so sometimes you'd end up with 30% more imagery because it kept all the images in the turns. And, you know, eventually people figured out how to kick those out and, you know, do it, or the software eliminates them. So it makes it faster. Faster, faster, faster. Less images is faster.
There's some, when you're thinking about how much overlap is required, 1% is technically all that's required. And we've proven this many times by doing corridor work where we have forward overlap, but it can still create a linear mosaic that's accurate on flat line. So if you have any overlap at all, SimActive is usually pretty good about tying those lines together. And we do projects as well where no overlap is desired because they were counting objects or animals.
Yeah.
So we do push that, the overlap, to the extreme on the other end sometimes when we're not doing technically mapping and photogrammetry. We're actually trying not to overlap and being able to use the minimums possible really helps us save time on that end of the spectrum when we're trying to reduce those doubles. So it's very useful to have that kind of flexibility in the photogrammetry process that you can pretty much use it to the fullest extent possible.
Now, are you finding that when you're doing the dual sensor collect with LiDAR, I would assume you're using the LiDAR as the surface for the project rather than having the surface created through the DSM process?
It depends. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Either the photogrammetry derived surfaces, sometimes we'll bring in third party surfaces, but it really just depends. A lot of times our LiDAR surfaces are so dense we have to thin them in order for them to work as a DSM. And as long as things line up like they should, there's times where we can actually process our LiDAR separately, process the in some active the imagery to control, put it on top of the LiDAR, and it matches up perfectly. And that's what's great about seeing those things line up when they haven't been part of the same project together, is we know the accuracy in the photogrammetry process because we have a double check. We got the ground control, and then we have the additional data set, and everything marries up really nicely. So
yeah,
you can, whatever way is either the fastest or makes the most sense or the best model that we're looking for.
Right. And then you're aware in correlated 3D, you can always bring in the LiDAR afterwards and then colorize it from the ortho mosaics.
That's something we haven't done a whole lot of yet, but I've seen the tools for it. So that's something we probably need to dive into a little bit more in depth once we have some breathing time.
Yeah, it tends to really impress the clients because they're not used to looking at classified point clouds or just point clouds with nothing, say an intensity image. But when you throw in the color value as well, then they can say, okay, now I can see the bulldozer, I can see, you know, the power line, all that stuff. So it's a pretty nice little add, you know, for the end user. But so one of the things you asked prior to us jumping into the webinar, you and I were chatting and we were talking about speeding up the workflow, and you jokingly said one thing to speed up the workflow is for Correlator 3D to speed up the workflow. And guess what? That's exactly what we did in version 10.1. The hardest part of the photogrammetry workflow, or the longest part, is the DSM processing. And we're happy to announce that we doubled our DSM processing speed. So now you're going to see lightning fast production when you're working with Correlator 3D. For me, I'd like to thank you for your time. You and I met personally at MAPS this summer for the first time, which is an association of us peers in the business, as we talked about earlier. Have you got any final thoughts?
Well, I would like to say the same thing. Thank you for your support of our business, because SimActive is constantly coming out with updates, and every one of them is valuable. And I appreciate all the work that goes on behind the scenes, and then the support, you know, just you reaching out when we're up at MAPS, meeting, talking, you know, what's going on. Is there anything we can help you with? That's something that we don't see a whole lot from software manufacturers. It's pretty much use our software. It's as good as it can get. If you have a problem, it's probably wrong. So the difference with working with you all is that, you know, we use that support, we expect it, and we get it. And I appreciate that. It's helped us to grow a lot as a company.
Well, I'd like to thank my guest, Don. Thank you. I'd also like to thank you, the listener, for joining us as well. This podcast was created in conjunction with a webinar. You can access that webinar as well as previous webinars and podcasts by going to our website, simactive.com, where they can be found under the Learning tab. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share on social media. You can also subscribe to this podcast through many of the popular podcast subscription sites. Once again, thanks for joining us. Until next time.